We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Feel like Kobe in the fourth quarter. This is the Dane Moore NBA podcast brought to you by Blue Wire Podcasts. I'm recording today with Britt Robson of MinPost. A little timestamp of, you know, where we're at when we're recording this is Wednesday afternoon, before the Wolves play the Sacramento Kings on Wednesday evening. So if something, anything happened in that game that is of meaning, no, we are currently blind to that as we sit here recording today. So Britt, you wrote your weekly column this week today on Wednesday rather than Tuesday. So that's why we're recording today.
Yeah.
And this time decided to focus on the Timberwolves defense this season, which I thought was not only an interesting topic, but an interesting time because the defense has been better at certain parts of the season than it is right now. Coming off of a good game, I would note that. But I think that kind of strengthened your point in that you wanted to talk about this team now, 13 games into the season, having really exceeded your expectations defensively. What went into this topic for today's column?
Well, part of it is I think the fan base is really cynical right now. And I think for a while, I was flummoxed because I really had a good vibe about this team and really thought that they would get out of the gate a lot faster than they have. Sure. And so that kind of, you know, you get a deer in the headlights look like, hey, wait, have I misread this or what's going on, you know? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I wrote a column one of the times, either the last time or the time before, just talking about the fact that they're kind of stained by their legacy, which, you know, was one of my attempts to try to explain this this weird lethargy where everything about the Wolves that you might have expected going in has been inverted. You thought they'd be a really good – I thought they'd have a really good offense. I just didn't see how they wouldn't. And I was hopeful for a decent defense. But I didn't expect it to be as good as it is. And so I began to say to myself, because I like to go against the grain as long as I'm sincere in my opinion. And the grain right now is that they're a bad team. And here we go again, same old Timberwolves. Well, even if they're a bad team, they're not the same old Timberwolves. They're playing the best defense since Rick Adelman left in 2013 or something, you know.
Right.
And there is... It isn't a fluke. I mean, there are a lot of good players. They have the best handful of quality defenders that they've had since, you know, since maybe Peck and Kirilenko and, you know, I mean, Rubio. I mean, there were like three or four really good guys in that Adelman defense too. So
Britt, let me jump in here. I thought, because we're sitting together at the games and we're talking, and
it's an ongoing argument between us. Yes.
Well, I honestly thought, because I do know that you like to go against the grain, and I know that you like you're trying to be authentic in that and
right.
and finding a lane to go against the grain. But honestly, I kind of thought you were wish casting something here just in our conversations, wanting the defense to be better. And I'm glad you wrote about it for that reason, because one, in our conversations, at the games, I've been disagreeing some that it had been as good as you thought it did. But I'm glad you wrote about it because you highlighted reasons it has been better. And I thought, I no longer think you're wish casting. I think there are genuinely things to be optimistic about. I think my pushback to you in our conversations, and I guess slightly in the column, is saying that the defense is good based on where they rank statistically. I don't think that is the reason to believe in this team. Obviously, it's very much still boosted by the first five games of the season when they ranked second on defense. Now, these last eight games, they're more like 25th in defense if you isolate for those times. So I don't think stats is the argument, which is why I'm glad you made other arguments in it, namely highlighting the handful of players, like you said, who are strong at it. And also the areas where they are weak, you pointed out that the defensive rebounding point was a really good one. They very clearly rank last in defense on this team. But you pointed out when they give up offensive rebounds that they contest those offensive rebounds really well. So there's a handful of things in there that me, a skeptic of this defense, made me go, okay, like I think there's something here, and I like that there's more personnel on this team individually that I like than I have, you know, since the Jimmy Butler year.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that speaks well for this defense is that they are not playing a style of play that ensures good defense. I mean, it isn't like they're throwing everything into being a good defense. This defense was designed to be adequate, and the fact that it's better than adequate is really pretty remarkable, given that the top three in minutes are still pretty shady defenders, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, Kat and D'Lo, nobody's ever going to put those guys on the all defensive team. And
well, Ant will put himself on the all defensive team.
Yeah, well,
hey, he had his best defensive. You would agree with that, right? Best defensive game of the season.
No, against Phoenix. It turned out to be 2,800 words, and I was already like half hour late to my very, very patient and generous editor. Otherwise, I would have gotten into a little bit more about. I wanted to get into the question I asked Finch the other night, which is, don't you think that this team now has a defensive identity better than an offensive identity? And he was saying, we are just missing good shots, which I don't believe, quite frankly. And we should be both. And what I would have liked to say if I'd, you know, gone over 3,000 words and really further bedeviled my editor was to say, what would happen if this team prioritized defense? What would happen if your accountability rested upon how well you defend? And that's true of the scrubs, but it's not true of the big three.
Well, they'd slow down a lot, right? Don't you think that's the biggest thing?
They also, though, the other thing I remember, and this is going to be another, and this may even wind up being a future column somewhere down the road, but Finch emphasized accountability a lot more in his half season last year than he has this season. He benched guys who didn't play defense. And I think some of that had to do with the fact that it's easy to be the hard ass when you're coming in and it's not your team and you haven't had a training camp and all this other stuff. And it's harder to do it when you've been with these guys preaching certain fundamentals from day one, and you know that you have a long-term contract and they have long-term contracts, and it's a pivotal year for everybody. Everybody's kind of under the gun, and you're less likely to be quick with your decision-making. And I think that's a mistake in this particular case. I wish that he did put a little more pressure on the, you know, especially on offense, but also to some extent on defense.
That's going to come, man. I mean, if the losing continues,
I don't know. You know, I really don't know. I think that...
Well, I'd hope so. I should say that.
The Finch idea of letting them play and letting the team sort itself out.
Right.
I think that is way past its due date on offense now.
Well, that's what I was going to say, man. Isn't it fascinating that, like... So this idea with Chris Finch is that he is this offensive mastermind for the reason that he understands how to let players play freely, like, and randomly, effectively, right. Freely and randomly. That was right. The idea. What we've seen happen
two
is he's
three.
Allowed. Well, we've seen it on the other end.
The offensive part isn't working.
Right. True. True. No, the offensive part, we could talk about that. The offensive part isn't working at all. But defensively, it's the same ethos. He's allowing them to play freely, randomly, and affect sometimes chaotically affect in an effective manner.
And that's going to be another, I mean, this is all these ideas I had in my head for this column, and maybe two thirds of them made it way in. But another idea is the more chaotic the Wolves defense makes it, generating turnovers, scrambling around, the better chance you unlock the big three on offense, because this team is chaos oriented on offense. They do better. Look at the Laker game. Well, all of a sudden they started to get some turnovers. Somebody hit a three. The next thing you know, everybody's scrambling. I mean, that offense was not a set offense when they got 43 points against the Lakers. They were guys coming down just jacking threes and, you know, and whipping the ball around and everybody moving. And I don't think there was a single play called for the entire quarter. I don't know. I mean, there may be no more than half a dozen plays called in an entire game on this team. Right. So,
well, they want to electrocute you. Like that's the goal,
and
without the stray
defense.
Voltage. Yeah, true.
That's stray voltage, man. That was genius, man. That guy's a poet.
He's what we're talking about is Chris Finch referred to, I don't know, what would you even call it?
Jostling in the paint against double teams, where he just exaggerates his elbow movements and flails around and just generates a phenomenal amount of performative energy to very little effect, is definitely stray voltage. I mean, it's a perfect description of the weird inefficiency of both energy and production that happens. It looks like there's a lot going on, but as a matter of fact, it's like one of those little, you wind up one of those toys and it starts to do all this stuff, you know?
I'm concerned. It's good. I mean, a lot of people are concerned about the Carl stray voltage, and you know they'll use the term flopping and this and that, and it's kind of an energy suck in a way to the team, which I think, you know, some of that's for sure true. What I'm most concerned about is I think that stray voltage is what has led Carl to get hurt in the past, specifically the one he drives, establishes a little bit of contact. And he's so damn big and gangly that he falls back. And both times he broke his right wrist, the same right wrist, was driving on the right side of the floor. The first time was in Oklahoma City, driving, I think it was against Muscala.
Right.
And then he fell back and he hits Muscala, falls back, trying to draw the foul, or did draw the foul, and catches himself with his right wrist. And that happened again in Utah. In what was that, the third game of last season?
Yeah.
Where it was the same thing against Gobert.
It's never the same, really. Right.
Well, he broke his wrist.
I know.
Or, you know, and so I have concern about it. And it really struck me because he was talking about in his post-game press conference after the Phoenix game, is like, I'm going to be here. You know, I'm going to be here, and the best thing I can do is be impactful and show up and do what I can bring to the table. And to his credit, for 90 whatever percent of his career, he has done, you know, he does that. He brings
absolutely
that offensive production, except when he's hurt. And both of his key injuries in his career are directly attributable to the times he's had too much voltage, causing himself to fall over, catch himself with his wrist, and break it.
Yeah, I would agree. That's all a good point. And no, I do. I think you tweeted something to that effect without getting into chapter and verse about it as well as you did there. But beyond that, I also think, in addition to being a courting of injury, it is also an unintentional signal for the refs to swallow their whistle. I mean, no ref, no self-respecting ref is going to give that kind of performative theater credence. I mean,
particularly this year when the rules have somewhat adjusted to account for that.
Right, right. I mean, the only way Cat could get that call is if Jaden McDaniels was guarding him.
Well, that's a good tie into more of the defensive stuff, because that's the next thing I'm going to write about is Jaden, because I think he's been one of the most like perplexing elements of this season. And I haven't done this yet, but I haven't watched it all back yet, but I'm going to watch all his defensive possessions at some point later this week. And off of the top of my head, what my mind or gut says is that Jaden McDaniels' defense has actually been good this year.
Yes.
And it is very much skewed and will be statistically skewed, particularly in those catch-all metrics that really negatively account for fouling, which is fouling's bad. Like I get it. But it, in terms of like, if we're grading the play, you're grading the film, I don't think from what I've watched thus far of Jaden McDaniels this season that he is defending poorly at all, which really does inspire room for upside. Cause I think the real problem with him has been on the offensive side of the ball, having almost no inclusion in the offense, which makes sense to some end, right?
Like, but that has begun to change, which I really like. He's been much more because aggressive since coming off the bench.
Which, okay, but that first game off the bench was against the Clippers, right?
Yeah.
And he got foul trouble, right? Well, he got put in the same pile in Ty Lue's mind of, we don't have to guard this guy. The first two times the Wolves played the Clippers, Zubats, quote-unquote, guarded Vanderbilt or Okogie, and Batum guarded Cat. And the plan was, if Okogie or Vanderbilt are out there, Zubats, don't guard them, stay in the lane. But when Taurean Prince or Jaden McDaniels are out there, we're going to adjust accordingly. They're, quote-unquote, shooting threats, offensive threats. We're gonna do that. What happened in the third loss to the Clippers is McDaniels was also disregarded in terms of being an offensive threat.
But then he put the ball on the deck and got some points.
Well, he took some shots. He shot 4 of 11 from the field in that game. And he got to the free throw line 6 times, which tripled his free throw total on the season.
Right.
So that's what I'm saying. Like, credit to him. I'm just saying part of that offensive inspiration comes from the fact that he was not being guarded, which is the plan now. Almost every team, other than the Lakers, who had the worst game plan ever against the Wolves. Right. But, typically what we're seeing is Jay Crowder, he's guarding Cat, Batum's guarding Cat, and the center's just lurking, ignoring Vanderbilt, Okogie, or McDaniels. So McDaniels has the best skill set to be able to exploit that, though, which is encouraging.
And back on defense for a minute. I mean, I'd love to talk about this a little for your future column, because you probably noticed that I use stuff that you give me in these podcasts in my columns. I just shouted out one where I gave Vanderbilt amputated right arm and said he would still shoot the same percentage. That's directly out of you constantly reminding me that he is overwhelmingly left-handed. So anything that you could steal from me, feel free to do. And I'll offer up a couple things in my opinion about Vanderbilt now, which are, McDaniels now, which are that a lot of his defensive troubles are ridiculous matchups. I mean, he's 185 pounds.
Right.
I mean, come on. I don't care how good a defensive guy you are. If the word out on you is that this guy likes to create space so that he can close for the late block, and somebody outweighs you by 40 pounds, they are going to collapse that space, and they are going to draw fouls on you. And then the second thing is...
Well, hold on. He also, it's ridiculous in two ways. He's guarding up big guys situationally when he's playing power forward, but it's also commonplace that he guarded Chris Paul the majority of the game. They took Patrick Beverley off of him to put Jaden McDaniels on Chris Paul once Chris Paul got going. So it's,
and Chris Paul disappeared for a while.
Yeah, but then he got going again. But it's more so.
Quarter, right.
The fourth quarter. It's more so, I mean, he guards a random array of players, which he is physically outmatched in different ways to be able to do. For sometimes he's too small and sometimes he's too big, you know, which ultimately I think is a credit to him to be able to guard 1 through 4.
Versatility. The other thing I want to mention that I don't think Jaden gets enough credit for is those, I think miscellaneous calls them stray plays or unknown plays or whatever. These places where there's a loose ball. Or there is nobody really knows how to mark this down on the stat sheet. McDaniels is in the middle of handsy scrums all the time. He's in the middle of making loose balls happen, keeping loose balls, staying loose, grabbing loose balls, whatever.
He's Covington without the hand strength.
That's a really good, concise way to say it. Exactly. That's exactly right. He has the instincts of a Covington in some respects, but neither the experience nor the strength to make it really happen.
And, you know, to be fair, Covington has some of the best hands.
Yeah.
Glovington, right? That was.
Hey, by the way, just a real quick aside, has nothing to do with what we're talking about, except that you said Glovington. When I was looking at defensive metrics, Gary Payton Jr.
Yeah.
The monster. Chip off the old block.
Well, okay. I love how they use him. And we've talked about this for 2 years now. And it was mocked by a lot of people, and probably rightfully so, given what the results have been. I was saying that Josh Okogie should play power forward for like 2 years. I've been saying that, right?
Right.
But my reasoning was one, getting
as a screener.
Yeah. I wanted him to be used as a screener, which we've never seen offensively, because you want him to be on the floor for the energy he inspires, and he does a lot of the Gary Payton things.
Yeah.
But I love how Golden State unabashedly uses him like a screener. And really, man, it's like Bruce Brown last year in Brooklyn. It's the same thing. And I don't know enough about
such a screener that he gets ignored. And then all of a sudden, boom, there he is. You know, I mean, he gets found by people because he knows how to cut, which Okogie does. Okogie just can't finish.
Right.
But I do love the defensive metrics in particular. Gary Payton gets all kinds of deflections, loose balls. I mean, the dude is a scrapper.
Oh, he's right up your alley. 100%.
He's a rich man's Wiggins.
All right, let's take a quick break, and then we'll be back to talk a little bit more about these other defensive players with Britt.
Today's episode is brought to you by 20 by 20 Solutions, a Minneapolis-based technology consulting company that works with your business to help you build and sustain success. A great front office puts together a winning team with a coach who can put together a winning strategy. When leadership does its job and it all comes together, that means success. Success in business isn't any different. Business leaders need to find the right mix of technology, strategy, and talent to make things really work. And that's never been truer for growing companies. 20 by 20's team has helped grow companies from thousands of customers to tens of millions by helping businesses across a wide range of industries, from consumer technology and healthcare to manufacturing and even human spaceflight. Reach out to Clark and Ben, who are Wolves fans and fans of this show, by emailing them at team@20by20solutions.com. That's team@20x20solutions.com. And their team will review your needs and help you put together a plan before you need to make any commitments. 20 by 20 Solutions, technology, workflow, architecture, strategy. They're your sixth man on a winning team.
All right, we're back with Britt Robson of MinPost. Just wrote a piece for MinPost on the Timberwolves defense titled, let me get the title right here. Defense. Defense has become a hidden pleasure of the Wolves season thus far. We've talked about Jaden McDaniels specifically. We mentioned Vanderbilt and Okogie a little bit in passing. We can hit on them a little bit more if you want. But as you put it, the players who epitomize the defensive identity on this team, the dude is Patrick Beverley and what he's been able to provide for this team with his defensive just wit amidst his hot-headedness, right? That he understands the nuance of how to guard on this team. And I think that when I just look at, this team's 12th in defense on the season, there's nobody in my mind that you can give more credit to for that boost than Patrick Beverly this season.
Yeah, I mean, imagine if they didn't have it. Imagine if it was, you know, they're riding with D'Lo and J-Mac at the point guard position and have to use Beasley consequently a lot more often on the perimeter defense. Mm. Which, by the way, for the third straight year, Beasley is the worst defensive net rating of anybody on the team.
I like the improvement. I like the improved awareness.
I don't think the results have necessarily improved.
Yeah,
but I think he's got a clue. It's just that he hasn't solved the puzzle with the clue he has.
What I'm really going off of when I say that is, when they traded for Malik Beasley, I did one of my defense binge watches, right, yeah, of him,
right,
and in Denver, and the awareness was a zero. It was really a zero, and I think some things have come together for Beasley, who let's overall say is you know, not having a strong season, coming in out of shape, not shooting the ball as well as he can. But really, a positive nugget I feel is that he has improved his awareness and understands the scheme. So I put in my notes when I was reading your column that he almost deserves to be put in the group that you said players who epitomize the defensive identity.
Are actually pretty good. I will say his deflections are good.
I think Finch wants some of the identity to be understanding of awareness and rotations. And while he doesn't inspire chaos in the way Okogie and Vanderbilt do, credit to them, he does epitomize what the structure of the defense is when they're playing at the level of the screen. The problem I've noticed with Beasley is when they're in drop coverage, he is not as effective because that's asking him to do different things. And the Wolves, like, we make a lot of the change in their defensive scheme this season. A lot of the times they're still playing drop and they're functioning their defense similarly. Like, we'll see what they do against the Kings tonight. I don't have a measurement of what it is, but it's not that far from 50-50 of aggressive defensive scheming versus conservative drop scheming. And I think that hurts Beasley a little bit. I think that
they still, I read a column, I can't even remember where it was, but somebody wrote that they underwent the biggest change away from drop of any team in the NBA. Mm. And I think that's probably true, because you can go from 90% to 50%. Yeah, that's still a really big change.
I'll take the over on 90 there too, from the Vanderbilt days, which you know, I mean, we both bagged on that a lot. And I hammered the drum of, like, you got to change up the defensive scheme. You got to change up the defensive scheme. And what I've learned this season is the importance, I think, of diversity of coverages.
Right.
Is not being one way or the other, adjusting for the personnel, doing that. We've even seen some zone. They're terrible at zone execution. But I think that's modern day defense. What?
Because they're lazy. You cannot. I mean, seriously.
Yeah.
A zone defense is only as good as your attention to it. If you play an alert zone, it is miles better than if you say, okay, I'm in a zone. I just need to make sure that nobody comes into this little square I'm standing in, you know? And that's what I see them doing. They don't have any proactive connectivity when they run their zone. And it's just disgusting, quite frankly.
Well, it's showing up in the numbers. This was maybe a game or two ago. I looked it up, just synergy tracks, points per possession allowed in man versus zone. And only 17 teams had run zone this season. So it's not for a lot of the teams, it's not a huge sample size. But of those 17 teams, the Wolves ranked 16th in points allowed per possession when they do zone up. And that totally, you know, passes the eye test of, like, they have no idea what they're doing in those spots. And I think that's a good point by you.
And what I will also say, just because to tweak you a little bit, even though I'm kind of on the Naz Reid bandwagon now, they run a lot of zone when Naz is in the game.
It's probably Naz and Cat minutes, right?
Yeah, a lot of that. But also, I see them run zone when Naz is the center sometimes, just because I think that they because Naz is quick, which is good to be quick in the zone.
What a development. That Naz is actually a quick player. That's true. I know. A true thing.
Well, they both are. They're both quicker, which it does have actually help the defense some. Mm-hmm. One of the things I did want to mention and did mention in the column, for as much as I rag on D'Lo and Ant and Cat on defense, this isn't happening in a vacuum. It isn't just four guys. The Wolves are playing decent chaos scramble defense. I mean, they D'Lo has a lot of deflections and some decent loose ball recoveries. Ant is, you know, part of it. Ant has so many minutes, but
D'Lo's boxing out.
That's right. I mean, there's a lot of things. All the people are trying to make progress, and I only wish that they had that same camaraderie on offense. You heard me ask Kat the other night. I thought it was a pretty direct question. What I basically was saying, are you guys ever going to sort this out? I mean, what I actually said was, has anybody among the three of you, have the three of you sat down and talked about best situations, ways to get touches for people in the right spots at the right time? And he wanted no part of that question.
It was an interesting back and forth, though. I played it on the last pod, so a lot of the listeners probably know exactly the whole like 2 minute back and forth of you guys going, I don't know. I wouldn't characterize it as that. I wouldn't say he wanted no part of it. I think he kind of like, he said, well, to be honest, we haven't had that conversation yet. Wasn't that the answer you were looking for?
Yeah, but I think he was fine with that, though. I think what I wanted was to, set him off on one of those. If ever there was a time to be self-righteous, and of course, then that's when he's equanimous, I just do what I do and we all, And then he went into that weird segue about
the play
that you saw him. You saw Finch call for a two-pointer. You told me that Finch had just called a two-pointer in the huddle. And Kat says, that play was supposed to go for me. Go to me at the three-point line. I told D'Lo that's not going to happen. What revisionist history? That was a weird, that's when you go,
yeah, not sure I believe it.
Well, I mean, yes, I'm not sure that you believe somebody saying something that you saw exactly differently. I can't understand why you wouldn't believe it. It's just the weirdness factor there is, it's confounding. And I say all this, in some ways, I love quirky guys, and in some ways it makes Kat more lovable to me because he is obviously, he's got some things that he just needs to work through in his own way, and they're fascinating to me.
And I think, if I could say this just for everyone listening, like, I think Ant always, when he talks post game, he always says something goofy, and one of us tweets it out and all this, and it goes viral, and I think it distorts the perception that Anthony Edwards is a spokesperson of this team in some way. Yeah. I don't know if the words avoid or what, but Ant does not do as many post-game press conferences or media availabilities as Karl Anthony Towns does. Kat always comes, and while sometimes his answers are quirky, I give him credit in the middle.
He shows up.
I give him credit for that. Yeah. I think he's all, I mean, they've lost 8-9 as we record this. And I think every time he's been requested, he's shown up and he's answered those questions. And that's part of the job.
I mean, again, quirky, you're not
his
quirky.
Version of honesty.
Exactly.
Yeah. Whatever. Yeah.
They are. That's what makes it so fascinating is they are honest. But he also, Chris Hine wrote the whole column about how everyone else thought that the Golden State game was great and Kat was disheartened by it. I was pleased to hear that. That goddamn Golden State game, whole idea that, they rallied and that was whistling past the graveyard. And yeah, they won the subsequent Laker game. But don't tell me that the genesis of the Laker win was this stirring comeback in the Golden State game where they lost their cornerstone defender and the team got hot from three for like 5 minutes And as soon as the game had to be won, Golden State woke up and won it. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
You know, I that's when I get impatient. I get impatient with these false reads of, you know, if you got to be optimistic, say, hey, our defense is kicking ass right now. And, you know, or we have relied on sweat equity denying points. And that's why we are in every game, you know.
Well, if the fight was an everyday thing, because I mean, then all right, like hang your hat on it. But while there's been games where they've been down by 18, 20 points and they've fought in the second half, the third quarter, fourth quarter, quote unquote, finished strong, there's also been games like that last Clippers game where right. they completely like folded as soon right. as, you know, it wasn't even a, I mean, that was not even a basketball game. They quit. Right.
Yes.
So it isn't like, yeah, we hear about this after pretty much every loss where it's like, you know, I'm glad that we didn't let go of the rope. We fought. And, you know, sometimes that is true, but ultimately it feels like celebrating moral victories and that's not okay.
And that's one of the things I have liked about Cat is he hasn't, you know, he got his cue. And actually, to be quite honest with you, I thought the Phoenix game was a moral victory. I'll take that. You know, that was the most enjoyable game of the season by a country mile. I really enjoyed the Milwaukee game too, but the Phoenix game, there's nothing like watching really, really good players have to elevate themselves to their best selves right in front of your face against the team you cover. I mean, Chris Paul was Chris Paul in full flower in that crunch time. Devin Booker was playoff caliber Devin Booker. You know, that's what I want to see. I want to, you know, when I go to the game, wins and losses don't matter to me as much as players revealing themselves in full flower. And that's why this team's defense has been so heartening to me, because so often in past Wolves seasons, they just got buried. And, right. and offenses knew that they could step on the gas at any time.
And often did at the beginning of the third quarter. Remember when that was a thing? It was like, come out. Yeah. And every single right. team that the Wolves played was the Golden State Warriors in the first 6 minutes of the third quarter. I saw some right. crazy stat today that since this is a simple Gary Payton aside, basically. But since Steve Kerr took over, this is nuts.
Oh, yeah. Did you see that? Too.
Yeah. Oh, my God. They are
what a great Warriors coach.
Are plus like 1,500 total points.
70,000 or something.
Yeah. And the next
and the
closest
second
team,
best is the first quarter, which are the two times you have to prepare your team for after a break in the action. Yeah.
And compared to other teams, it was just, yeah. I mean, obviously, some of that is having the talent and stuff to do it. But the Wolves have always been a team on the opposite side of that spectrum, right? Not coming out in the third exactly. quarter ready to go.
And you can't tell me, I mean, this year may be just his most masterful job. Nobody can tell me that Golden State has the most talented roster right now.
Yeah. They do have Belly, though.
Who's allowed to shoot threes beyond lip service.
Yeah, and sometimes he does.
and Mr. Big Shot, that was a name that didn't age well.
Well, not while he was here. We haven't really talked about
Shout out to Aaron Aflalo.
we haven't really talked
best
about
best moment.
let's take another break and then let's talk specifically about the Cat, Ant, and D'Lo dynamic that now we're 13 games into this season. Just where those three are at and not synergize. Take a quick break. We'll be right back with Britt.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
All right, we are back with Britt Robson of MinPost, discussing just the Timberwolves in general now, 13 games through the season as we record this. The last game the Wolves played was the Phoenix Suns game, where Karl-Anthony Towns had 35 points on the night, 16 points in the fourth quarter, but did not take a shot in the final 2:18 of that game when it was winning time. And it was the latest example, I guess, with this team of the inability for D'Angelo Russell, Karl-Anthony Towns, and Anthony Edwards to synergize. And Britt, I thought going back and watching that, as I'm sure you did for your column, it was very interesting to me to juxtapose that against what Phoenix was doing on the other side of the ball, who in ways has a pretty similar big three, right? And Devin Booker, Chris Paul, and DeAndre Ayton to what the Wolves have in their big three. And I thought it was impressive by Phoenix the way that they included all three of those players to generate late game offense by consistently running high pick and roll with Chris Paul and DeAndre Ayton, having Devin Booker rise up off of that through pin downs, made a couple of mid-range shots, hit Ayton on a roll one time when Cat overcommitted to Chris Paul on the perimeter. It was exactly what you would have loved to see the Wolves do, understanding that the usage of your big is going to be lower in those times as it was for Ayton, but not removed completely. So it just... really, the Wolves' big three strikes me as kind of immature, inexperienced, not able to execute in these late-game situations like some of the better teams in the league can.
Yeah, here's a thought experiment. Swap D'Lo and Chris Paul. Have Chris Paul play with Ayton and a Booker, and have Chris Paul play with Cat and Ant, and have D'Lo play with Ayton and Booker. What happens?
Wolves win?
I don't know, but all I can say is it's unfair to D'Lo. He will suffer by comparison. So will every other point guard in the NBA when it comes to fourth quarter floor generalship or whatever you want to call it. I mean, Ricky Rubio is very good at it, but nobody is as automatic from mid-range when he wants to get his own shot as Chris Paul. Mm-hmm. And that separates him from all the other point guards in terms of the fact that he is unselfish until he decides he doesn't want to be unselfish anymore. And those times are always when his team needs a pick-me-up. He's one of the top five point guards of all time. I'm comfortable saying that. And,
well, this game epitomized it, man. I mean, he had 2 points through the first three quarters, exactly, and he finished with 21. I mean, 19. Right. He had 19 in the fourth because he spent a lot of the time at the beginning of the game, as he always does, trying to get his guys off. Like, if you look at Chris Paul's first half scoring versus second half scoring, you know, for years now, that's an intention of his. And quite frankly, it's kind of the opposite with D'Lo, where he tries to get himself off first, and also is a good passer in his own right.
I dislike about him the most. First 5 minutes of the first quarter, and some of it may be that he knows he's sitting early and he doesn't want to come into a second rotation having gotten really very few shots off and no rhythm when he's going to be called upon to, you know, lead an offense.
The second unit, yeah.
But all I can tell you is if you need to shoot at least put forth the effort to get yourself in a position shoot. I know he's a bad shot maker, but let's remember the first part of that phrase. He's shooting bad shots, you know? Yeah. And when he's not making them, it just ruins the early momentum for this team. And that happens a lot. I mean, yeah, he's been cold at the beginning of this season. And to be fair, he has been pretty solid in crunch time before Monday. The fact of the matter is he's running the show for the 26th most efficient offense in the NBA that has Karl Anthony Towns and Anthony Edwards as options. That's an indictment. That's an indictment. And consequently, take a page out of, you know, the Godhead's book, get other people involved like Chris Paul does. And then what do you know? Your shot, if you want to be a crunch time hero, you'll look even better being a crunch time hero because your other teammates will give you the dap of knowing, hey, he got us off first. Let him go. As it is now, you know, I know that Kat and D'Lo is supposed to be buds, and I know that Ant is, you know, been kind of unselfishly biding his time. No one can tell me the three ceiling elite scorers, I wouldn't call them all elite scorers, but they all have the capability of being elite scorers. With the game on the line, watching somebody else lose that game is not something that you're going to be fine with. And if you are fine with it, quite frankly, that's a problem too. There needs to be a come to Jesus meeting between Finch and those three, or those three on their own, or, you know, maybe even throw Beverly in the mix, for God's sake. I don't care. But something has to happen where it isn't the elephant in the room. It isn't, you know, D'Lo attempted six shots in 103 seconds to end that game and made one of them. And the team lost by a bucket, a three-pointer.
And Cat shot zero in that time.
And Cat shot zero. And to be fair to D'Lo, the NBA just came out with a report that said he was fouled on that. I think it was the final shot. Yeah. And maybe that would have gone in. Maybe he would have been 2 for 6. But the greater point is get everybody involved so that the opposing defense feels a multiple threat. If I'm an opposing defense, I key on D'Lo the last 2 minutes of the game because I don't think he's giving it up very often.
I think, Britt, what this is also, and we're early in the season, but what this is also coming to a head in bringing is a collision of the reality that this season is decision time for a commitment to this trio on the roster as currently constructed. And it's a bit confusing given the fact that Karl Anthony Towns, including this season, has 3 years left on his contract. D'Angelo Russell, including this season, has 2 left on his contract. But the nature of how contracts work in the NBA for max players is that Karl Anthony Towns with 2 years left this summer and D'Angelo Russell with 1 year left this summer are both extension eligible. We heard D'Angelo Russell mention that on Media Day, that it's right. It's a contract season for him. And I think to a lot of people, you go, well, they typically only give contract extensions to players who are kind of at least playing to their current level of their contract. So I think with, you know, a group of skeptical Wolves fans, I would say D'Angelo Russell has not yet lived to that max expectation yet here. So what is he doing talking about getting an extension? But I think that's bearing the lead in the fact that he wants it and expects it. So people are like, well, you know, just have him roll it over another year. And then, you know, when he becomes a free agent, he either leaves, he goes somewhere else. Well, what we're seeing in the NBA now is if this ain't it, you know, where they're at, like they move on and, you know, leverage their way out. So I think for D'Angelo Russell, he's going to be thinking about this season, or determining this season, of whether or not this is it or not, or if he wants to,
if he wants to move on again, probably, you know, via trade. And more shockingly, the same situation is coming together with Karl Anthony Towns, who is also extension eligible.
Okay, two things. First of all, shout out. You publicize my columns all the time. You're now writing. You're writing. Yes. Bring me the news. And I thought the best part of your opening column to bring me the news, bringmethenews.com, is that where it's at?
Yep.
Folks who prefer reading to listening, I know there's just millions of you out there right now listening, but Dane wrote a really good column about, you know, how Ant and Kat divvy up usage to some extent, or at least figure out roles, leadership roles, whatever, for now and in the future. But the I thought almost like breaking reporting, even though, you know, it's been a fact laying out there that you happen to seize on, I think, at a particularly good time, is this idea that, you know, Kat has a contract that he can exercise. And that's a dynamic. Never discount the importance of money in the background when you're dealing with any kind of NBA chemistry.
Yep.
So there is that. So that's the first point I want to make. Shout out to that column. And then the second point is D'Lo may be veering dangerously close to Terrell Sprewell territory in saying, hey, you know, let me go find a better deal. Spree thought that 3 years at $21 million was chump change and he'd go find something, and there wasn't anything better, and he retired. Now, D'Lo's not going to retire, but I will tell you, if D'Lo thinks he can hit the open market and do better than $30 million a year, I await that comeuppance, you know,
right.
Because that's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm. He would need to have just a stellar final 65 games of this season to,
yes,
you know, to, for the Wolves.
Well, D'Lo's going to make unhappy noises about his deal under current performance.
Mm-hmm.
Then D'Lo is Spree-like delusional.
Right.
And if I'm Sasha Gupta, I say, oh my goodness, you know, just don't promise me a good time here with this desire to, you know, mm-hmm, storm out the door. You know, that gives me the excuse of packaging you for something and pivoting. And if this season continues the way it is, particularly on offense, a pivot in some way, shape, or form is inevitable.
Right. And I think the more, well, impactful, obviously, if it happens, move would be Karl Anthony Towns leaving. And I guess we can kind of collectively paint this picture. What the situation is at the end of the season, he'll have 2 years left. And he's eligible to sign a 4-year, $200 million extension on top of that, which is the exact same thing that Joel Embiid, who was drafted 1 year before him, just signed in Philadelphia. Like, that's the book, or that's the path to be taken if he wants to commit here. He also has two other paths to be able to take, which is one, the obvious one of, you know, requesting a trade and leveraging his way out of town. Which, you know, happens with players when they're 26, 27 years old all the time. The other one, which I think is a little bit more interesting because he's not a player of Joel Embiid's caliber, or specifically Giannis Antetokounmpo's caliber, is what he could say is he could hold leverage and be like, no, you got to go all in this summer, bringing me my guys, and I will delay signing my extension for another year until you prove to me that this is the place I want to be. That's what Giannis did in Milwaukee. That's what inspired Jrue Holiday coming in and all the other moves, Milwaukee going into the luxury tax for the first time in decades, all that.
That's what Kevin Garnett did post Cassell and Sprewell, and it just absolutely torpedoed the Timberwolves for the rest of their time there. He was one of the worst talent scouts, you know, ever.
Right.
James is my fourth guy. Troy Hubson. Trenton Hassel, you know, get my guys in here. Yeah,
right.
Great. So,
well, I think with
Dwayne Casey fired because Dwayne Casey couldn't coach those guys. I mean, give me a break.
Right.
I love KG, but that was not his finest hour.
Well, it's a historically dangerous, you know, area to toil in. Obviously, Milwaukee found success in it, but because Giannis is
one of, if not the best player in the league. And I just think that this is very much a possibility of a path that Kat tries to take. And it will be interesting to see how Sachin Gupta or whoever is running the Timberwolves next summer handles that, because you don't have to say yes to Kat's demands in that sort of way. And because you deem them maybe not a good idea. And if you do that, now you are the one who is basically, quote unquote, forcing him out of town by saying, we're not going to do that. You're not going to be happy as it's currently constructed. Let's make a trade. We're going to trade you. You're not requesting a trade. We're going to trade you to, you know, recalibrate around Ant or whatever it may be. So there's just there's this fascinating decision tree that is coming. It is coming this summer. And it's why I think it's frustrating as a fan to go, oh my gosh, like you want to trade and build around Ant. Well, you can have 10 first round picks and you're not going to get a player as good as Karl-Anthony Towns. True. But that is not the context of the situation. This is the scenario. If you of course you want to keep a good player like Karl-Anthony Towns and Anthony Edwards together. They are 20 and 26. They are young. It seems odd to blow up that pairing. But as we know, the collective bargaining agreement in the NBA and contracts shape the chessboard in the NBA.
And also, I need to point out to people who like to dream up these scenarios and like to telegraph, oh, get so-and-so for so-and-so and don't do this or get rid of this guy or keep this guy or whatever. The shape of the puzzle pieces is always morphing. They are not stagnant puzzle pieces. Guys who fit together 2 years ago may not fit together now. Guys who didn't fit together 6 months ago may fit together really well now. It depends on the coach. It depends on maturity arcs. It depends on
surrounding pieces.
Yeah, all kinds of things. And putting together a team, especially in an environment as dynamic as roster building has become in the NBA, it's not a crapshoot, but it is not a science. It's fortune telling as much as anything now. And as a result, you know, I kind of like the idea of a dedicated, compassionate bean counter like Gupta. You know, I'll take his intuition, you know, as well as anybody's at this point in time, simply because I don't think his ego is so bound up in it. But before all that happens, I want to see, and this will probably waylay the conversation a little bit, which is, you know, probably I'm due for it right now, what about if we let Kat and D'Lo run some pick and rolls, for Christ's sake? I mean, I don't understand the avoidance of that.
Bizarre.
Because it has two players working in sync, doing things that they both have proven to do well. And I'm on record as being a skeptic as to why you got D'Lo in the package you got him for us, because he was such a great pick and roll player with Kat. But that was the initial rationale of Gerson Rosas, and that rationale...
His stated rationale has
been totally ignored. And every now and then there was a play the other night when they ran it and it went really well. You know, well, I mean, it's was so like incongruent. Seeing a zebra, you know, hey, what do you know? You know, that was a pretty cool looking thing we just saw.
To the Rosas point, it's like, all right, stated reasoning for getting D'Angelo Russell, amongst others, of being a scorer, but stated reason is high level pick and roll player will come together terrifically with our elite pick and pop player we already have in. But the incongruence is then going out and hiring a head coach that his stated belief is as little pick and roll as necessary. Pick and roll is like a break glass in case of emergency sort of thing, because as he says all the time, his desire is flow. Pick and roll is in nature stagnating. It is. So
whatever Rosas was like envisioning, and I know D'Lo came in before Chris Finch, but we also know that a lot of the Chris Finch pieces were in place well before they were set. It's bizarre. And quite frankly, just a really bad move.
And it's unfair to D'Lo. It's probably right. unfair to Cat, but it's certainly unfair to D'Lo because...
Dude, remember D'Lo and Jared Allen in Brooklyn?
Yeah, I do.
I mean...
I've loved Jared Allen for a long time. I mean, you know...
Ricky and Jared Allen in Cleveland now?
Ooh. Oh, my goodness. I know. And that big line. Wait till that big line gets a hold of the Wolves front court. I mean,
you know what I noticed, though? Cleveland is like... The Wolves are dead last in rebounding. And the Cleveland's like third to last. And I think Philadelphia with Embiid is second to last.
Is really good.
Yeah. So
it isn't necessarily about rebounding. That they use their size really well in terms of both rim protection and just in terms of deterring.
Mobley's just a stud.
Mobley's a great guy. Mobley was the guy that everybody thought Okongwu would beat. At least I thought Okongwu would be.
I was skeptical on Mobley. I was skeptical on Mobley.
Yeah, I didn't pay attention. You know, I don't follow the college game, especially in the draft. If the Wolves don't have a pick, I figure I'm wrong. As you know, the only guy I've ever been right about in the draft, I took one look at the guy and I said, that guy sucks. He'll never be a good NBA player. It was Hashim Thabeet. I saw him and I said, anybody who takes that guy is in for a world of hurt, you know.
You know, ironically, when I was going through your column today, I wrote it down in my notes when you were talking about the Wolves' offense just stagnant and quite gross in the half court. And
inaccurate, unimaginative, and indolent are the three words I used.
Right. I think what came to my mind was I haven't historically been a huge draft guy either, but during the pandemic, I watched all those guys.
Yeah,
nothing to do. Yeah. And so Anthony Edwards, I watched every offensive possession, every defensive possession, but specifically to the offensive possessions. At Georgia, the offense felt so much like the Wolves' offense feels now. And it's almost hard to characterize because it doesn't totally make sense when you have Anthony Edwards, who's this brunt force at the rim, who, yes, questionable, you know, shot selection and this and that, but he also has this ability. You saw it at Georgia, multiple hand finishing and passing. This guy who should not only be a scorer, but somebody who should inspire playmaking. Right. Yet, both at Georgia and on the Timberwolves, the offenses, when he's on the floor, stagnate. And we put a lot on D'Lo as we have today. We're harsh on Cat when whatever happens with him, stray voltage and such. Some of this, and I don't even know how to exactly like articulate it or bullet point it out, but I do feel some of the offensive stagnation is attributable to Anthony Edwards and just the way he plays basketball in the half court that has a little bit of a delay to it in mm-hmm. some sort of way. And it's, you know, certainly could be something he's grown out of, but thus far from Georgia to last season, to this season, he hasn't. And offenses too often stagnate when he's on the floor.
I agree with everything you just said. I will insert the caveat that when somebody is just as miraculously gifted as he is, there is a tendency to stand around and watch what he does next, even if you're a teammate. Mm,
sure.
You know, you think all of a sudden, because you see it many times where Ant is at the top of the key, and you can just tell by his forward, you know, he leans forward a little bit and you're thinking he's going to go. And the last thing in the world, you don't want to cut. You don't want to go to the corner and distract him. You just want to stay put and watch him try to thread his way through six guys because he has in the past. And on the other hand, what all three of those guys need to do is make quicker decisions, for God's mm-hmm. sake. I mean, dribble, 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 dribble. You got three guys. Finch says that he's all about ball movement and movement off the ball. Neither thing is happening. It nope. makes Chris Finch look really bad. And his paralysis in the face of this is making him look worse. I'm a big Fitch guy. I've gone on record saying that, you know, I think he's the best coach this team has had since Adelman, and maybe Adelman's peer if he becomes as good as I think he can be. And Adelman is a Hall of Fame coach. But he's not covering himself in glory on offense. And I will say, on the other hand, as a Finch Bobo or whatever you want to call it.
A Finchie.
A Finchie. Yeah, I hate that. I hate that nickname, Finchie.
I hate it.
It just sounds so, you know, so puny. Who wants to be called Finchie, for Christ's sake? Anyway.
It's interesting. What I talked about on one of the more recent pods was this idea that the imbalance of the roster, which is pretty undeniable, plus the lack of cohesion between the big three, which both those things Finch is somewhat, he holds some blame in for sure. But to some extent, it might just be an unsolvable puzzle given the roster that he was handed. And it's interesting because it's starting to have an adverse impact on the perception of Chris Finch on this team, who outside of Anthony Edwards was the most unassailable gem on this team. And now people are starting to question it. Right. And so
as they should, on the other hand, give the guy credit for this defense. He has flipped the,
I'm still not as high on it.
But, I don't care whether you are or not. I just wrote a whole column about it, for God's sake. He has put together a defense that is almost the mirror opposite of what the Wolves used to run.
Yeah.
And even a skeptic like you watching the games has to admit it's a pretty fun defense to watch.
For sure.
These guys are flying around, and you've lit a fire under some people's rear ends. You brought in some people that are perfect to run it. I mean, and Finch, I mean, when Joe, whatever his name was, I don't even remember his name anymore. The guy who went to Washington was the defensive
Joseph Blair. Yeah.
Joseph Blair. When he left, I mean, Finch talked to me that very day. And I think he could have cared less, you know? I mean, I really think that, you know, and then when I mentioned Nelson Turner and, you know, how that affects, he pretty much told me, hey, the defense has been my thing from the jump here.
Right.
And Nelson Turner said, he knows what he wants. It's my job to give it to him. I mean, there's no secrets that the changes in the defense thus far this season, and I think they've been the best thing about this team this season thus far.
I might give Finch, you that.
Is Finch is doing, I know, against bad competition. But I would also say that you're saying that some things might not be able to be solved. I would like to see some effort to try to solve them. And I don't think my sense of Finch is that he is still in let them sort it out mode. And I think that needs to change right quick.
Well, what I think is interesting related to all of it is the happenstance of the situation of Sachin Gupta, you know, running the show. And as Chris Finch's star falls, if it does, and I think it has to some extent, through a 4-9 start to a 13-game season, you have to, if you're Gupta, in the back of your mind, be thinking about making this guy look good. You don't want that star to fall because his star is tied to you.
Yep.
And so I'm just saying, if I was in Gupta's shoes, I mean, I would have been thinking about it from day one as soon as I got, because I don't think the roster's put together well. But I would be even more intentional now about changing this roster for the obvious flaws that it has, but also for the negative externalities that it's having on a very important person in your organization and a person that's very important to Gupta's future here. I would make a move just to make Finch look better.
And there's value in that. They swear by each other. I mean, they both just gush when they talk about the other.
And not Rosa style.
A really strong personal relationship.
Yeah.
No, right.
Genuine. It's
sincere.
Yeah, right. That's pointed out. No, so it's those two are tied together.
The back of our hand here toward the end.
Well, I'm sure he's done the same to us, so that's all right. I think it's an interesting dynamic there. If there's anything I'm most fascinated to figure out about this season, is what Gupta's going to do when the trade deadline comes. And really, what I feel confident in saying is I know he has a very different philosophy in terms of roster construction to right. Rosa's, but we don't have evidence of, or really suggestions of, what that difference looks like. So as somebody who's into that, you know, sort of thing, roster construction, the idea of building, I'm fascinated to see how Gupta builds. And I think there's a fire being lit under his butt, given that this team has started 4-9.
What's funny is that, you know, one of the reasons I think these pods can be interesting is we have very, very different ways of looking at the game. And you're already, you know, telescoping what's going to happen, you know, in February and beyond, if not before then. And I'm thinking to myself, just get the offense together, keep the defense in the state it's in, and make a little run. I mean, I mean, that doesn't get said often enough currently. Everybody's back in default mode of,
trade cap.
Oh, this team sucks, you know? Mm-hmm. And as somebody who I would say 7 out of 10 times is more cynical about the fortunes of this team than most of the fans, I'm here to say that I have a more faith in the raw materials that are on board right now than you and most people, I think. I mean, the way I'm reading the room, it's essentially you've got a serviceable defense. I mean, that's a gift. That's something nobody anticipated, that facts. You were going to have a defense that could keep it together. And I know you're just letting me go, and rather than
I don't think the defense has exceeded my expectations. Right. It's just not, my perception of the defense is not where yours was. And I actually don't think it's that different, because I asked you at the game when we were sparring about where you thought this team was going to finish defensively, and you said 15th, right?
Yeah.
That's not an unrealistic expectation. That's not you saying, I think they're going to be a top 10 defense.
Oh, no, they can't. They don't have any rebound. I mean, they also can get crushed the Clippers will beat them 12 out of 13 times.
Yeah.
I mean, they have no answer for a rugged, deep, physical team that has the arrogance of knowing they can win good games, you know?
Dude, that's the single scariest thing, I think, if you're a Timberwolves fan right now, if you care about the immediate, these next 5-10 games, right, is the book is out. Play them rugged, guard Cat with the four, ignore Vanderbilt, Okogie, McDaniels, and fluster this team into being full of stray voltage. We've seen Orlando do it. We've seen the Clippers do it 3 times. We've seen the Suns do it. It irritates this team in a way that they do not really know how to handle. And credit to them, a little bit better in the Phoenix game against the when Jay Crowder was in that spot. But Phoenix wasn't dogmatic with it. They went with Ayton on Cat when McDaniels was at the four. They only went with it when Vanderbilt was out there next to him. So, you know, there's degrees to this, but man, that when we're talking about the immediate, we got to synergize the big three, but you got to figure this out, because there is a book. The Phoenix Suns would not have guarded Cat this way. They never have, or they didn't last year in the times they played him. They would have never defended them this way if they had not watched film on the 3 Clippers games and the Orlando game, which broke the Wolves' offense by guarding Cat with a small.
Well, the real test will be how Utah does. Because Utah, I mean, that's a fascinating. They've always, Cat has always given them weirdness in terms. They haven't been able to figure out how to match up with Cat. They're probably one of the most successful ways is having Gobert play out of position on Cat and ride with it anyway. You know?
Yeah. Remember that back to back they had 2 years ago against them, where Cat killed them, Yeah. And then the next game, Gobert guarded him like he was Patrick Beverly. Exactly. And Cat had 10 points. I remember that. I love the chess.
It was a great rondelay, no doubt about it. Yeah. But I do think you need to have a situation where you lower the throttle on chaos. You need to, the more chaotic you can make the opposing offense play, the better your own offense will be. I'm pretty confident of that after seeing these first 13 games, because it frees up all the chemistry questions dissolve into the moment. You know, somebody coming down the floor, somebody's running on the right side. It's obvious, you know, D'Lo isn't going to ignore Ant flying down the right wing if he's got the ball in his hand. Cat isn't going to ignore a double team as the, if they're playing 4-on-3 and two of those guys are on Cat, he's more likely to quickly find the open man than to indulge in stray voltage. Chaos is enhances decision-making on this team. And that chaos can be created the way the Wolves like to play defense anyway. Now, is it risky? It's really risky, especially if you have the personnel to counteract the chaos with just simple talent and bulk, you know. Sacramento is not one of those teams, in my opinion. So I would like to see a very chaotic defense against Sacramento. Little Lou Dort on Fox action.
Right, which only you and I understand.
people saw that game. Lou Dort picked Fox's pocket and then,
to win it,
even more miraculously, drove the length of the court, did some hang time while a guy partially blocked his shot and put it in. I mean, that was a wonderful play.
He's a two-way player, man. He's a two-way player, Lou Dort.
Lou Dort, right.
All right, Brett, we gotta go to this Wolves-Kings game now. I appreciate you cutting out some time here on Wednesday to do this. Again, check out Britt's piece on the Wolves defense that he is as excited about as I can.
Well, it was a reaction piece, you know. The two before were, I decided not to write immediately after a game because you're still invested in what you just saw rather than taking a moment to go bigger picture. And that was fun when I had to do the Cat reaction piece after he, won an Oscar for starring in some Tennessee Williams play in his own mind. But, it was a perfect thing to react to. But I enjoy a little bit more thought sometimes. So that's what happened.
No, it's a good one. And it's going to be interesting to track. You know what I mean? What's going to happen here?
Well, if they'll wind up 27th and you'll go, hey, remember when you thought they had a good defense?
or, you know, the whole study. You know, we don't know. To be determined. Well, he's Britt at Britt Robson on Twitter. Check out his work at MinPost that you can read there. I will not be having a post-game pod after tonight's Kings game because it's back-to-back, so I will be back to talk to y'all next after the San Antonio game on Thursday. Until then, he's Britt. I'm Dane. Talk to you soon. Peace out. How I'm feeling, man, I hope it never stop, yeah. Green and hot so you can find me in the crowd, yeah. Don't let standards ever bring you down, yeah. Hope you dancing like nobody else around, yeah.